This is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Unless, of course, you have wisdom, in which case you don't need any more information.
Adam Trombley is the director of Project Earth for the Institute for Advanced Studies at Aspen. He's proven to be one of the most influential and unorthodox scientists of his generation. In 1980, Adam and a colleague, Joseph Kahn, designed and applied for patents for the closed-path homopolar generator, a potentially revolutionary design for super-efficient generation of electrical power. In June of 1982, international letters of patent were published by the International Patent Cooperation Treaty Organization. In 1983, Adam began to dedicate his efforts to Project Earth. The late R. Buckminster Fuller is quoted as saying, "Project Earth is a human design experiment. It will be incumbent upon human beings throughout the Earth to become a living network, to demonstrate the power of working synergistically with all their environment to ensure a future worth living in." In 1984, Adam was awarded the R.J. Reynolds III Endowment for his efforts with Project Earth. As the 80s progressed, copies of the closed-path homopolar generator patent had circulated throughout the world. In 1986, one scientist, Paramahamsa Tiwari, who at the time was the head of the quality control for the Torpor Atomic Power Station in Trombay, India, Tiwari published results of the experiments carried out with a crude facsimile of the machine described in the patent. In the American industrial journal, Magnets, Tiwari wrote, "The test results have shown an efficiency of the machine above 250%. It was the first time in human history that claims of greater than 100% output had been independently verified by a bona fide third party using a description of the art provided by the patent document." This further propelled Adam and Project Earth into the international spotlight. At the largest new energy technology conference ever held in Hanover, Germany in 1987, Paramahamsa Tiwari had brought his rather crude facsimile of the Trombley-Kahn generator. The next day, Adam gave one of those lectures with an impact that never seems to leave you. Adam continued his research into the new energy technologies with a colleague, David Farnsworth. In June 1989, in New York City, Trombley and Farnsworth physically demonstrated a small solid-state electrical transformer that measurably showed an efficiency of 54 to 1. Adam then walked down the street to the United Nations and gave an address. As a result of that talk, it's hard to believe that the entire world didn't change as a result. The American people in particular have still not gotten the message that there's an entirely new and benign option to the current death spiral of humanity. As a result of ignoring the opportunity that was presented that day in 1989, the world still suffers under the tyranny of fossil fuels and global power structure, which seems bent on the eradication of the entire species. Today, Adam continues to pursue the work of Project Earth in spite of the fact that, in his view, the destabilization of planet Earth has reached critical, even nearly irreversible proportions. Well, we're going to be talking to Adam Trombley again this week. This is a continuation from our previous aired interview that we talked so much that we got another whole interview out of it. And he'll be talking about all kinds of different areas. Welcome, Adam.
Hi.
Hey, great to have you. Great to continue talking to you on, but I know there's been a week apart, but it's the same taped interview. We're just doing two parts to it because it was so interesting talking to you about these different areas. So we'll continue with that now, okay?
Absolutely. My pleasure. So basically, once you begin to understand all these different integrated dynamic processes, and one of the things I also say is every morning when I wake up, I remind myself that the first step on the path of wisdom, this is from Plato, is the confession of ignorance. And And literally, this is imperative on a daily basis, because otherwise the ego takes over, you know, and you think you know it all. And it's like, the more I learn, the more I realize how much more there is to learn. And so in the process of examining, for example, I mean, when I was 13 years old, I guess I was 13 years old, almost 14 years old, in 1965, I was visiting Yerkes Observatory, which was the observatory at the University of Chicago. And there was a 40-inch refractor there, which was still considered a significant instrument at that time, is, of course, now considered kind of a beautiful antique. I met a guy named Gerald Kuiper, who was actually had come back. He was in the process of leaving there, and he was moving, and he had come back for some meetings, and he happened to somehow or other, we ended up in this conversation. And basically, in the process of engaging in a conversation, he kind of got a gleam in his eye, and he said, "Wow," he said, "I'd like to tell you some things." And he told me that Jupiter was radiating more power, more energy than it could possibly be receiving through insolation. So this was another seed that was sown in my psyche, in my brain, when I was 13 years old. And he said, if you can understand how this happens, you could go a long way to solving the world's energy crisis. Of course, the Kuiper belt of asteroids is named after Kuiper, but he did a lot more significant things than that, too.
Okay.
Including, always asking these questions about the dynamics of the major gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn. But we have... We need to understand that by inspecting these systems, by acknowledging to students, for example, that Jupiter radiates at this point, we have more of a spectral understanding, we have much more broadband understanding. So we're over four times now more power is being radiated by Jupiter through non-thermonuclear processes than it could be receiving through insolation. There is a constant loop current between the planet Jupiter and Io, which is interesting to me because this was written about, this was published in Science in 1979, and yet there's somebody who got a dissertation approved who was talking about how the heating of Io was being caused purely gravitationally, which is not true. It's being caused also by this loop current, which passes from the equatorial region of Jupiter right through the planet, which was measured by Voyager and the magnetometer on board Voyager, and has never been discredited. And anybody who says it was discredited is short of the truth. Let's put it that way. This is a very significant thing, this article that appeared back then called Jupiter's Homotopic Dynamo. So again, here we have data acquisition, which I always get back to. We are acquiring data about our actual world, not the presuppositions about our world, not Victorian or some kind of belief system dogma. We are acquiring actual information about how our world works. We're seeing a planet which is not a star, which is radiating more power than it's receiving from the sun. We're seeing this. We're seeing superluminal jets coming up from quasi-stellar objects and being rationalized endlessly by ass-kissing people in the field. I shouldn't call them that, but it always just disconcerts me when they insist that they know that Einstein put this limit on the speed of light, which is just horseshit. Pardon me. I feel very strongly about this. Rolf Schafranke made a presentation at the University of Toronto in 1981 where he spoke very directly. Now, this is a NASA scientist, a top NASA scientist, working with von Braun, saying the speed of light is not a constant in that presentation, which Planetary Association for Clean Energy out of Toronto has in its proceedings from that particular conference. And suddenly they say, oh, the neutrinos, we've measured neutrinos at CERN. Now, CERN is trying to justify its existence because of the failure to identify the Higgs boson. And so suddenly CERN acknowledges, well, we've known this stuff since the 1980s, for God's sakes. We've known it since the 1970s, some of this stuff. We had, even at the little Bevatron over at the University of California, Berkeley, which is a tiny little accelerator compared to most of these monsters now, they had particle tracks that indicated particles that existed for far longer than they should have existed, given the energy that was put into the experiment. where did they get the energy? They got the energy out of the zero-point vacuum fluctuation background field or out of the quantum ether or whatever appellation you want to tag to that presence, okay? And you know, I was called in by a friend of mine over there at Berkeley to see these tracks, and he was just so excited about it because he felt like this was like a fundamental discovery that this background field had to exist because it was contributing to the momentum and the temporal integrity, the temporal longevity of these particles and these particle tracks, which were too long. They lasted too long, man. And so this balloon was punctured a long time ago. Actually, it was punctured by Nikola Tesla. But Nikola Tesla, one of the problems with Nikola Tesla is he pretty much refused to speak the language of his peers because he felt like he had none. And in point of fact, he didn't for the most part. But he still could have been more, perhaps compassionate is the wrong word to use there. But he could have been maybe
accommodating.
Accommodating may be a good word. Yeah, that is a good word. But whatever the case may be, we've known for a long time that this field exists. And Einstein actually said before he died, I didn't ever say that there was absolutely no ether. I just said that the constraints that were put upon the ether in the 19th century were untrue, and that was proven by the experiment by Michelson and Morley. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an ether. You know, he said that at the University of Leiden in 1936, I believe, in Holland when he gave a presentation there. So we've got these things that we're taught as laws, the second law of thermodynamics, you know, which is bantied around like, you know, somebody's got a bachelor's degree or somebody's got even a PhD and they're going around, well, that violates the second law. Like there is a second law. The second law is relevant within certain frames of reference, but it totally doesn't take into account the results of an enormous number of experiments, actually, and that are quietly articulated in scientific journals sometimes, like Physical Review Letters, which is one of the most exciting sources of information in physics. I spend an inordinate amount of time, sometimes into the wee hours of the morning, poring over articles that are constantly appearing there that are not integrated into through the presentation in these letters or in these papers. They're not integrated into the total body of physics at all, but they are pointed out as anomalies, you know, or new discoveries of new levels of macro scale entanglement, for example. And I always say, look, at anybody who's ever been intimate with somebody, anybody who's ever loved somebody, anybody who's ever been a friend with somebody understands something about entanglement on the macro scale, because there's always that time where your best friend from high school is thinking about you and you're thinking about him or her, and suddenly the phone rings, or your cousin Kathy, or your, you know, et cetera, your Aunt Barbara, whatever it is. Somebody calls you, your mom calls you, your dad calls you, and you knew you were already there with them. You were already in pre-conversation in your psyche with them, because you're intimately, molecularly, atomically, and on a quantum level entangled, which is superluminal, which isn't about fast neutrinos, man. This is way beyond fast neutrinos that are somewhat superluminal in their speed. It's way beyond even quantum jets coming out of quasi-stellar objects, polar quantum jets that are superluminal. We know they're superluminal. That's the data clearly shows they're superluminal. Well, beside all these rationalizations by these people who want to keep themselves aligned with the now obsolete priesthood, anybody in the priesthood who will not embrace the quantum ether is an anachronism. Just like the cosmologist who said before the Big Bang there was no space, even right up at the University of Toronto, people who were given $100 million in funding not that long ago, who are now saying out at the Institute there outside of Toronto, oh, guess what? All of this cosmology is occurring in this context, which is already there. In other words, I always, when I heard that, the first time I heard that, I almost retched. From a very, very well thought of scientist, I almost literally, physically got ill. I said, how can you be that stupid? And of course, he just thought I was a young, arrogant fool. But I literally said that to him. I said, how can you be that stupid to say that before the Big Bang there was no space. And he looked at me like, well, you just don't have the sophistication, son, to understand this yet, you know? And I was like, no, don't look at me like that. I said, look, I grew up around PhDs. I grew up around government scientists, NASA scientists, you know, whose work sometimes, like Jack Bregman's, who's one of our neighbors, who developed a hydrophilic internal coating for the space helmet that never was implemented in the NASA spacesuit, in the Apollo spacesuit, or any of the, you know, it's a hydrophilic coating that they put on the inside so the damn thing wouldn't fog up, you know? I mean, this guy invented this, and it was never integrated. I mean, I knew these people personally, you know? And it was like, this is the failure of the communication of intelligence through our collective neural network is not because we aren't already connected. Aunt Barbara calling, or your dad calling, or your lover calling, or whatever calling, and you know, I was just thinking of you, you know? How many millions of us can relate to that statement?
I think
all of us, you know, it's like sometimes, you know, it's like people who are scientific materialists have this happen, and they go, well, I wonder how that happened, you know, but they don't really talk about it in public. But the thing is that we are perfectly interconnected. This field that John Archibald Wheeler first articulated some of the math regarding this field in 1962 in the Review of Modern Physics. Of course, I've mantrically repeated this forever. I've been aware of it since school, you know, basically what he said was that if you use the Planck wavelength of 10 to the minus 33rd centimeter as a constraint on the amplitude or the background fluctuations, these are density fluctuations, okay, in the background field that pervades all time and space and beyond time, okay. Because time is a constraint of a universe and not space.
Okay.
Space is infinite. The only thing that's timed is a temporal entity like a universe, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Okay, so it's like a bubble that bursts. We are in a bubble that has burst, and therefore the gases are escaping more rapidly because there's no surface tension anymore, And it's basically a remarkable process we're involved in. It's remarkable that we can even acknowledge, and we've evolved enough cosmologically, in spite of all of these dogmatic hurdles that people have to get through, of people saying things, ridiculous things like before the Big Bang there was no space, because then they're trying to explain all of this as a pushing apart by dark energy. It's not a pushing apart of dark energy. It's a bubble bursting in a giant, huge under pressure. Okay.
It's, so infinite.
It can no longer assert its separation from infinity, in other words. And you know, the fact that density fluctuations arise in the midst of infinity means that density fluctuations can be induced. And that means there's something to induce density fluctuations into. Okay? In other words, there's a sea in which ripples can be made. Okay? And Wheeler called it a quantum foam. In the textbook, one of the textbooks we used years ago, and they still use actually today, by Wheeler, Meisner, and Thorne, called Gravitation, which is kind of the Bible of gravitation. I used to joke with him about it because I said, you know, basically, gravitation is obsolete. And before he died, we really did joke about it because he had to acknowledge that we were no longer in a primarily gravitationally dominated singularity. This universe was once a giant black hole. A giant singularity. That's what this universe has arisen out of. And this giant singularity is in the process right now of dissolving into the background luminosity, which is pulling at it, not the dark energy and dark matter pushing at it from inside. The vacuum fluctuation is not the result primarily of mass radiating, which Tom Bearden and other people have addressed in a very, very intelligent way. I mean, it is also that. There's definitely a species of vacuum fluctuation, which is as a result of the constant radiation of longitudinal radiation or what I like to call holomorphic radiation into space. Every single moment, every object is being the dynamic modification of the space in which it appears. Every single moment, every atom and molecule, every boson, everything. Is being the dynamic modification of this sea of energy. There is no stasis to it. There is no quality of stasis, nor has there ever been. It is a constant sea of change. It is a blossoming process. It is a transformative process. It is transfiguring, even, because ultimately we begin to realize beyond the subjective event horizon of our primitive and now archaic and obsolete ontology, because it is kind of a cancer, actually, when I think about it. But our obsolete cosmology has us thinking of ourselves as being separate, you know? And in point of fact, when you have a field that you know, is 10 to the 93rd power, 10 to the 94th power grams per centimeter cubed, mass equivalent energy pervading every cubic centimeter of space arbitrarily inscribed in space in front of you. Okay, that's 10 with 93 or 94 zeros behind it, okay, grams of mass that would be required to produce that much energy in a nuclear detonation. If it was, it would be, have to be beyond a nuclear detonation. It would have to be a zero-point detonation. And that's a whole other thing. But the fact of the matter is that this is always the case. Every atom molecule of our body is basically just being this dynamic modification of field space. We're being taught that we're separate little artifacts of the Big Bang, you know, like the shattering of the light, you know, but we're not the byproducts of the shattering of the light so much as we are a collapse within the light. In other words, this is a precipitate. This universe itself is a precipitate, a singularity that the esoteric people would say was a subjective collapse. Okay. And the good news is that there was a limit to that collapse. Thank God there was a limit to that collapse. Thank goodness. Thank the Tathagata Garbha. Thank the presence of the all-pervading field. I don't care what nomenclature you put on it, but thank goodness that there was a limit to collapse. Okay? Because this whole universe represents, even with the dark energy, maybe 10 to the 93rd power grams per centimeter cubed, with the dark so-called Sol Perlmutter's weird tag for it. I call it the boundless luminosity of infinite being, okay? And I'm not the first one to call it that, okay? But this goes back to Padmasambhava, etc. The boundless luminosity of infinite being, which has as it, one of its primary components intrinsic awareness and compassion. But the thing is that in the midst of infinity, a universe like this can arise, and this is obviously a lesson being learned by this conscious process that we're involved in. Because once you've learned this lesson, I'm sure you wouldn't want to repeat it.
Right. And in what way?
You wouldn't want to repeat it. You wouldn't ever want to create a universe where people could torment and torture each other intentionally to sell products. Okay.
Okay.
Well, you wouldn't want to create a planetary situation or a universe where planetary situations where this kind of corruption can dominate, because this planet is dominated by corruption. It's dominated by it. It's dominated by people who do not have basic intelligence. It's dominated by people who are so convinced of their singularity that they would exist at the expense of all other beings. It is dominated by people who are unintelligent, no matter how clever they are. There was a Star Trek show, Next Generation, which was, the working title was originally The Stupids. I think it may have even been broadcast under that title. But I remember talking to Gene about it when it was in development. And you know, it basically, this planet of really basically kind of stupid bipedals, kind of hominid types, sends a signal out into space, a distress signal out into space, saying, help us, help us. And so the Enterprise comes in, and Jean-Luc and everybody wants to help these poor people because they're in terrible trouble. And in point of fact, this was a cheese on a mousetrap, and the Enterprise was being attracted in so they could hijack it.
We gather stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
We get other stuff from smart people.
That's right. You remember this one.
And yeah, they sent over Geordi, and then they kidnapped Geordi. Stuff better.
That's right. And this is all about us. This is all about the planet Earth. The higher civilizations come, you know, their craft gets shot down by electromagnetic pulses that weren't even intentionally directed to shoot them down. but we create like we, you know, and you know, you have these situations which, of course, then we're told didn't happen, like at Roswell, and basically we acquire these technologies, you know, and or we form an alliance. We actually had a treaty. And we did, and that's why certain people like at Area 51. I mean, I know these guys. I mean, I can only speak to it to the point I can say that these agreements expired in 2003, and when Al Gore became president, full disclosure was going to be, well, I don't know if Al Gore would have had the cojones to do this. Okay, I question that, but some of us hoped that this would happen. But instead, the election was not allowed to be carried out as an election, and it was a coup. It was a coup d'etat by the first W administration. I'm not even sure George W. Bush was aware of what was going on. I assure you Dick Cheney was.
Okay.
But, I mean, at least as certain as I can be of what he was certain of. Of course, I can't be perfectly certain of that.
So in that show, that new generation show, the people depicted as the Gatherers – and when Geordi came on and he fixed their warp drive or whatever, wow, you're smart. And you know, give us more stuff. So those guys are us.
You got it. Those guys are us. And they really are us. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we've been doing. We've garnered this incredible technology from beings who basically wanted to help us. They really wanted to help us, you know. I'm not talking about, I mean, the Greys, whatever you want to say about the Greys. I mean, we're going to be far flung if we go off too much into this. But considering the fact that I worked with John Mack, who was the former head of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical Center, who was fired from Harvard by writing his book Abductions because he became convinced that through interview after interview under hypnosis of many of his patients, that the evidence was so compelling that abductions were really occurring. And why were the Greys abducting people? Well, they're breeding and they're hybridizing and doing whatever they're doing. They're biorobots, basically, who have become kind of insane biorobots, in my opinion. There's a kind of insanity that has taken place there. You know, but that's
I've
a whole...
I've thought of and, the
But I was able to talk to this guy who was the former head. Sorry, I was able to talk to this guy who was the former head of psychiatry at Harvard about these things very openly, with him being very knowledgeable about it. And yet the public is kept, you know, well, you could buy abductions. You could buy the book, you know, and I recommend right. People do buy the book, but these things actually, this is a part of what is actually also modifying our behavior as a species, because people have experienced this trauma. I worked with a psychiatrist named Lee Sinella very closely for years. He was the person who introduced, well, it's too much to get into Lee. He wrote a book called The Kundalini Experience, which was originally called Kundalini Psychosis or Transcendence, which was a book which literally saved thousands of people from being committed to mental institutions when they started having Kundalini phenomena arise in their adolescence. They had visions or stuff like that happen. The standard procedure was to give you shock treatment and put you in a mental institution. And Lee said, no. This is a part of human culture going back thousands and thousands of years. People have visions. People have evolutionary leaps. They have epiphanies. You know, Watson and Crick, tripping on LSD, discover this, the double helical structure of the DNA, which, by the way, they have acknowledged that they had this inspiration when they were on LSD. It's like contrary to the normal pharmacopoeia that wants to make you as unconscious as possible, as frequently as possible, and for all of your life, if possible. They would just want you to be good, you know, worker bees and make lots of greenhouse gases, reduce the oxygen tension in the atmosphere. Now, whose agenda could that be? Okay? Whose agenda is that? And so this is the kind of thing that we have to ask ourselves. We have to ask, as we said before, who is it that's doing this? And, you know, it's one thing to say, well, it's a corporate hegemony. That's a convenient grab bag statement that I make sometimes too frequently, I think. It's because it's much more sophisticated than that. the level of technology, when David Farnsworth and I were first monitoring, when he was first monitoring and called me to see what we were monitoring up in Oregon, what he was monitoring, because I hadn't seen it yet, and I saw all of this amazing stuff, intermodulated lily waves and double helix broadcasts going on. That were looked like chromosomes with genes coming off of them, that were, you know, marching across our screens as we were receiving this data from HARP. It was like, well, what? This is a biological weapon that's being used.
You know, biological in what way?
You can manipulate.
You mean affect DNA?
Yeah, you can change people's waveforms. I mean, brain patterns. You can literally change people's state of mind. And if you coordinate HARP with broadcasts for the Super Bowl, I recommend that nobody watches the Super Bowl this year. That's my recommendation. Of course, that's going to put me in very bad standing with the NFL. And it's not because I don't like football, because I actually do like football. It's not because of football. It's because maybe instead of saying don't watch the Super Bowl, watch it with a great deal of discrimination. And if you suddenly find yourself back in love with Barack Obama again afterwards, then raise some questions about what you've just been entrained with. Barack Obama should never be elected president of the United States again. And I think there's people who feel the same way about your leadership up there in Canada.
Oh, yeah. I feel the same about all leadership in general. Well, I think you're not going to be allowed to be a leader of a country unless you're dancing to the tune.
Unless and until people say enough is enough. And so why would I risk my life by talking about all these things? In the first place, there are scientists who say, as soon as they hear this stuff, there's even editors of one editor of a fairly supposed to be a leading edge magazine who called me a nutcase and said he was embarrassed that your former ambassador, James George, wrote highly of me in his book because he is so offended that I talk about UFOs. I have people within my own family who just say, oh, please don't talk about UFOs because that's going to destroy your career. Well, in the first place, it's like I'm 60 years old. I've had an amazing career. I really have.
Yeah,
I've had opportunity after opportunity. I've had amazing ability to be able to do science free of the stricture of the body politic of this time. So anybody who's going to tell me I'm going to destroy my career, I'm 60 years old. The Earth is getting killed. It is dying. We have high energy particle storms that are happening that are getting right through the degrading. The rapidly decaying ionosphere over South America, the hotspot for the South Atlantic magnetic anomaly. The South Atlantic magnetic anomaly was first discovered in the 1600s, when compasses of ships exploring the east coast of Africa, suddenly found this place where their needles pointed north when they were going south, and there was an area. It was only 100 some odd kilometers big at the time, where there was northern polarity off the coast of South Africa in the 1600s. And since that time, this has grown to encompass all of South Africa up into Central Africa and widening like a horn, like a megaphone, across the Atlantic Ocean, now all the way across South America, all the way across Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, out to beyond the Galapagos. We have this area where the ionosphere, which is our secondary shield, and basically no less important than the primary shield, because remember, this is all one system, so to call it a secondary shield is kind of erroneous, and I should be careful of my own articulation. But this is really important to understand. We are in an emergency on this planet. We're talking about every time there's a solar flare that hits the day side of the Earth with Brazil facing the sun, there's a mutagenic event that's about to occur. Every time there's a major solar flare that we are actually in the solar, when we're in the actual current sheet, we call the solar wind. Sometimes we're more in the center of it than others. Sometimes we're kind of above the center of it and below the center of it because it's helical. It's a helical expression of a current sheet equatorially from the sun. And that's what we call the solar wind. It's very, very energetic protons and electrons being expressed.
We just had an X-class flare last week.
Yeah, we just had an X-class flare, and we've been having more X-class flares. It's not going to be. It was a long minimum in the solar cycle, but now we are starting to see. And people can go to the Solar Dynamics Observatory site, which is an absolutely wonderful site, which gives us data from one of our newer satellites. Before that, we had the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory that went up back in the early 90s. That allowed us to watch the sun in wavelengths that we'd never been able to see it before, and see these massive coronal mass ejections that really were feared to be apocalyptic when very, very conservative scientific materialist type scientists saw these events. They thought we were going to get destroyed by them. But our magnetosphere was still relatively intact. And of course, the decay was in the process of decaying even then. The inner core of the Earth is changing its orientation, and therefore the fundamental polarity of the Earth is changing. And this is not a far-fetched statement. I remember in the mid-80s when I would say this in a lecture at Berkeley or, you know, Hopkins or someplace, there were people there who, they never attacked me in public. They would always backstab because they were cowards. And they would say things like, well, you know, that's far-fetched, you know, if they acknowledge the polar reversals happened, they said they only happened every 400,000 years or something, which is absurd. Because polar excursions happen far more frequently than that. And global seismic disruptions happen far more frequently than that. And this is what, for example, We have a number of people. Velikovsky studied this, and he was a psychiatrist, but he found it interesting that he found consistent representations by cultures throughout the world that at one time the sun arose in the west and not in the east, which indicates a total flipping of a planet.
Are we talking about a magnetic flip or a polar flip?
Both happen. Okay.
Okay.
But what we are in the midst of right now is a magnetic flip. Okay. And it would appear to me at this moment that there may be there have been polar excursions that have occurred because of the interface between the inner core and the outer core, the liquefaction of that interface over time. And there's more and more drag on the system as a result of that, that basically, lends itself at a certain point, the inner core may suddenly seize like a car clutch and grab physically in a intact frictional coupling to the inside diameter of the outer core. If that was to happen suddenly, then you'd have a change of what we call the spin moment of the axis of the planet Earth suddenly, and you could have giant tsunamis that were miles high that would also. The poles could change very dramatically physically at that point.
Now, do you see this as a possibility now?
Well, we're talking, yeah, it's a real possibility right now. What we're seeing the evidence of right now is a breakdown of the coupling between the inner core and the outer core. And we're seeing this migration, this wandering, you know, why did we have to go to GPS? We could correct with computer the magnetic pole and get it back on track for the real spin moment or the true north pole. Okay, we could do that with a computer. Why do we have to have GPS? Why did we have to have Loran C before that? Because basically the magnetic field of the planet is an inconstant. It's not a constant. It's inconstant, and we have polar excursions. Very few people. A very small handful of specialists knows about this, but we have polar excursions where the poles wander. And this kind of interesting parade, you know, and that's not at all the North Pole is right here magnetically anymore at all, and hasn't been for decades. It hasn't been for some time. The North Pole is not in one place. The North Pole is wandering. And is this the result, as Lamont Doherty Observatory scientists and others before them have suggested, that the inner core can rotate independently from the planet Earth? I mean, from the rest of the, not from the planet Earth, but independently from the rest of the Earth. You see, as this, as the integrity of the frictional coupling between the inner core and the outer core loosens, then the inner core becomes more and more autonomous in terms of its response to different gravitational stresses, like lunar gravitational stress and solar gravitational stress. I don't want to get so technical that I lose people, though.
Right. And, but the danger of that, Adam.
But the fact of the matter is, but we're not speaking in math here. I mean, you can articulate all of this such that it is, you know, you can articulate everything I'm saying, actually, mathematically, and actually, and have a much more refined statement as a result in some ways. But the thing is, you can also say it in plain English. Right. And basically, what we know is we have a moon that is way big for this planet. And it causes tremendous gravitational tidal stresses, okay? That's one source of stress. We have an unstable magnetic variable star. Now, when we're educated in school, most of us never hear that the sun is a magnetic variable. Most of us are just told if we take a science class or a couple astronomy classes, we're told that the sun is a main sequence star, meaning that it's a helium, a hydrogen-helium fusion kind of environment. It's main sequence in that respect, but it's not main sequence in the respect that it's a very, very small percentage of stars that are magnetic variables that reverse their polarity, which our sun does. Our sun reverses its magnetic polarity every 9 to 12 years. We call it the 11-year sunspot cycle. But in point of fact, what's happening is that the sun itself is reversing its magnetic polarity, south-north, north-south, every 9 to 12 years. And this was one of the slower, this is one of those 12-year half cycles that we're in right now.
Right, from the Mondor, from the minimum to the maximum of solar cycle 24. Yeah,
the actual Mondor minimum was a specific event, and it was an extended quiet period on the sun. And so we have, and we have a very interesting situation as we become aware of the fact that we have an older, unstable magnetic variable star that is shedding tremendous amounts of mass in its instability, and we have a decaying magnetic moment for our planet, and which we have exacerbated greatly by burning fossil fuels, when through divine providence or whatever feature you want to attribute this to, Nikola Tesla, actually before the fossil fuel revolution, which wasn't really before the fossil fuel revolution, because coal was already being reused in the industrial revolution, obviously, and the steam engine already existed and stuff. But like, it was as if higher intelligence, and Nikola Tesla, by the way, directly stated this several times publicly, that he received his inspiration from higher intelligence that were not of this world. And of course, this is another reason why he was marginalized and anathematized. But higher intelligence...
Yeah, he didn't seem to have any problem standing up in front of a room full of people, talking about science, and in the next breath, talking about the stuff he's learned from other races on other planets that he had tuned into and gotten information from.
Right, higher intelligences.
Didn't bother him a bit.
No, and you see, the thing about it is, that if you're not in an isolated kind of planetary frame of reference, which is unfortunate, because there are planetary civilizations that have evolved billions of years more, and they're not even a part of this universe anymore, basically, except for through entanglement. And entanglement has continued for some of those way beyond their tenure in this universe. Once we begin to understand that the context in which we appear is infinite, and that the context in which we appear, the context is eternal. It isn't timely. It isn't timed, you see. Time is something that is a phenomenological coefficient, okay? Time is something that is based on the appearance of a phenomena and the disappearance of a phenomena. We are in a phenomena, as I said before, the bubble has burst. The cosmology of recollapse into a singularity no longer pertains. This universe is not going to collapse back into a singularity. And for some reason, some of my colleagues who are cosmologists find this very disconcerting, and it has caused them. I've talked to one guy who was suicidal a couple of years ago because of it. He says,
"Now I need to understand that. Why would that affect them that way? Is it just because they've spent their whole lives thinking about the universe cosmologically in a certain fashion?"
Yes. And they identify with it. You know, it's kind of like they may be scientific materialists, but they're identified with the stuff of it. So if the universe expands out to a certain point and then collapses back into a massive black hole, that's just fine. And then it happens again. It doesn't matter to them. It's like that's true cosmic insanity from my perspective to ever want to do this again, to ever have this universe be this way again. You know, where people like Jesus get crucified and Buddha gets poisoned and Milarepa gets poisoned, et cetera, et cetera. And Einstein is basically anathematized. People have very short memories and don't study history very well, so they don't go into the planetary memory and realize that Albert Einstein, when he imposed nuclear bombs, hydrogen fusion bombs, was marginalized and anathematized. He was literally isolated. When he had the opportunity to have his heart corrected, he said, why would I want to continue to live in such a strange world? This is from the book Einstein, His Life and Times. We're given a picture that is convenient again to the beings who are controlling this planet, who are parasitizing this planet, whose activity is the definition of parasitism. It meets perfectly the definition of parasitism, where the resources of an organism are exploited to the benefit of another organism, and the organism that is the host is killed. This isn't symbiosis. This is parasitism. The corporate hegemony, that means British Petroleum and Exxon and Exelon Nuclear and all of these companies are parasites on us all and on our planet. And it's always interesting to me that, you know, even in the literature of Christianity and in Revelations, when the seventh angel blows his trumpet, he says, the time has come to destroy those who would destroy the earth. I've always found that fascinating, because there is a certain point where I feel, and this is just my very clear feeling, that there is a certain point where high intelligence says, okay, this is enough. Just like a person who has cancer says, you mean there's a treatment? I can take nanogold particles. I don't have to have chemotherapy. I can take silver particles that are hyperoxygenated and it can kill my cancer and I don't have to have any negative side effects. It will make the choice of curing the cancer instead of choosing not to cure the cancer because they don't want to go through another round of chemo.
Okay. Or, yeah, taking chemo at $8,000 a pop, yeah.
Yeah, or $30,000 a pop, as Avastin, trying to keep somebody alive for 30 more days or 45 more days is anywhere, it depends on where you are, strange to say, it's anywhere from 30, in the United States, it's anywhere from $30,000 to $90,000 just for that extra month, where this horrible toxin, which is also an anti-angiogenic, which can be replaced really easily with nano gold particles and also nano silver particles that are hyperoxygenated, silver dioxide, nano silver dioxide can act in this way, or hyperoxygenated silver, maybe silver trioxide even, or even more. Who knows? I mean, I don't know what the limits are because I haven't done the science. All I can say is that we know these things do work in their own way. We also know there's limitations. For example, nanogold has its limitations. But I don't want to go off on a huge tangent about that. What I'm saying is higher intelligence would make a choice because this is in its own morphology that this universe arises. This is it's in the morphology of the infinite presence that a planet like Earth arises. And no highly intelligent civilization, let alone a divine being, a truly awakened divine being. I'm not talking about one unique. I'm talking about there's actually ultimately only this, okay? Only, now I'm not talking about some historical individual with some name associated or some specific image associated.
Long white hair and a long white beard sitting in the cloud.
I'm saying the infinite beingness of existence itself is intrinsically aware and not schizophrenically dissociated or sadistic or masochistic. Having discovered this virus, this viral situation in its own system, might say the time has come to destroy those who are doing this. And it's no more, it's not hateful. It's loving. It's loving because basically I use this analogy. When you're in the tub, or not the tub, but the shower, and you take a loofah brush or some other exfoliating brush, okay, a sisal washcloth or something, and you scrub off the dead epithelials. Millions and millions and millions, tens of millions of dead epithelials are washed down the drain. And you didn't do that because you were angry at them. You did it because they were dead. It's the same thing when there's unintelligent beings occupying a planet. When there's unintelligent beings occupying a planet who've been given every opportunity at every turn, who've been given zero-point vacuum fluctuation technologies for over a century, and yet are told where the general population is told that anybody who says this to you, but they're told this subliminally, that anybody who tells you this is a nutcase. And anybody who talks to you about the reality of UFOs, even if it's Edgar Mitchell, you know, who's a cultural icon at one point, as I was growing up, Edgar Mitchell goes in public. Admiral Hillenkoetter made a taped interview, a filmed interview before he died in black and white, saying that all of this stuff actually really happened and there really are aliens. You have Fife Symington, former governor of Arizona, finally acknowledging that he lied on television about that craft not being of alien origin. He acknowledges to a good friend of mine who I met at the Cambridge Institute in 2003, he acknowledges to her that he lied about it and that it was actually real and he knew it was alien origin. He knew it was of alien origin. We can either ask for help from higher intelligences or we can continue to be subject to the stupidity of the people who are running this planet. And you know what? The new economy can be based on universal abundance. Like, why did we continue to invent after, I can tell you, there's been at least one attempt on my life for every year I've lived, okay? And I mean, I'm talking about to the point where I actually have been physically poisoned, you know, not where the bullet missed, which happened once. Went right by my ear, a 50 cal bullet did, but it missed. But I got very fascinated that it got that close at the distance that we determined it had to have come from. So I studied long range shooting as a result of that. And you know, just, it's a fascinating thing. It's an interesting little weird destructive science, but it's kind of also kind of interesting. It's, you know, it's a lot of kinds of ballistics and windage and all kinds of things you got to take into account.
So somebody takes a shot at your head,
yeah,
and you go into the science of that.
Yeah, of course, because I wanted to understand how we got that close. I mean, I thank God that I moved my head at the right moment and that I could actually feel the breeze of it. It wasn't just that I heard it. I felt the breeze of it and then the thunk in the earth right behind me. And then I dug it out, you know, and it's like, okay, holy shit, glad that missed, you know, duck and cover.
Yeah.
You can bet your life I did not stay there.
you made a run for the house.
It was like, it suddenly occurred to me, what the hell am I doing? You know, it's like I'm crawling around. This guy could shoot me again. Or try to shoot me again. But that was only one time. But the fact of the matter is that doesn't matter because they're killing everybody. You see, this is, I've been speaking mantrically again since 1979, 1980 about the global Auschwitz that we are all being subjected to. This, the earth itself has been turned into a concentration camp. You know, and people are given fluoride in their water, which interrupts their calcium metabolism. And then they're given D2 instead of D3, and D2 only helps you partially metabolize calcium. So,
and we're talking about the vitamin D2.
Vitamin D2.
And I've spoken previously on the show about the importance of going and getting a good source of D3 and taking it every day, and not just taking a little bit of it. Taking 4,000
units at least.
4,000. Yeah, yes. 4,000, 5,000 of what I've said.
Yeah.
A day.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's despite how much solar exposure you get. This is essential to understand because it helps you metabolize calcium. You have to counteract, and you have to get away from the poisoning. You have to drink reverse osmosis water or deionize it and then rebuild it up. I mean, you know, I'm in the process right now. Well, I won't even get into that. The fact of the matter is we do a lot of work with water too, by the way. We've been working with water for a long time at the Institute for Advanced Studies because it is such an essential thing. I worked with Marcel Vogel, who was the most productive scientist for IBM ever. Like the hard disk, the liquid crystal display, things like that, he was the lead inventor on. And we worked on the remote polarization of water molecules through cohered fields, for example, in experiments at Sci Research, where I worked with him for a while. It's like there's so much, there's such a bounty of stuff that we can glean, that we can realize. But the thing is that right now we have to get rid of the people who are killing us. And this is like Treblinka. This is a concentration camp called Treblinka. And because of a bombing raid destroying a supply convoy of trucks coming to bring food and fluoride, by the way, was one of the things that this was carrying, because they put lots of fluoride in the water supply, again, to make people docile, to make people impotent, to make people sterile. Okay, that's why the Nazi German regime used this in concentration camps. And the supply got interrupted. I knew somebody who was an Auschwitz survivor whose brother had participated in the Treblinka rebellion. And he was also a chemist. And he said that after the supply of fluoride was cut off, because it wasn't just cut off for a couple of days, it was cut off. I mean, that was like, it was like cut off for a significant enough period of time that people started going through withdrawals from fluoride. And they all woke up one morning, not they all woke up, but a lot of them woke up one morning, as I pray the human species will in general. And they said, wait a minute, we outnumber them. We outnumber the people who are killing us. We outnumber the people who are forcing us into forced labor. We outnumber the people who are forcing us into bankruptcy. We outnumber the people who are forcing us to take medicines that are actually killing us. They're prolonging our life long enough so they can exploit they can steal more money through the insurance industry, okay? They or through our collective insurance and state-insured medical systems like you have in the United Kingdom and in the Commonwealth, which is a superior system, by the way, in many ways, although we do have more technologies that all this money is bringing to the fore.
So all these people woke up one day and what? And they rebelled?
They took over the camp. And they killed the bastards. They killed them. Now, that sounds like an unloving statement. Why would a Tulku, a loving being, say something like that, okay? Why would somebody who has any kind of intelligence say something like that if you're a liberal pacifist, okay? And I'm saying that there's a certain point where you've got to wake the up and say, enough is enough. And that's why Thrive is coming out. That's why this movie is coming out.
And Thrive, let's talk about that. What is it about?
Because Foster Gamble, who's one of the heirs of one of the largest estates in the United States, the Procter & Gamble estate, woke up in his early life and said, what the is going on here? And why should this continue? Why is it that human beings can't thrive on planet Earth? Why is it that we torment each other and we invest all of this time and energy in the technologies of death instead of the technologies of life? Why is it that we subject populations to nuclear power plants when we know they're intrinsically unsafe, that they're intrinsically destabilizing? Why is it that we would expose people to the dangers of these technologies when we know that there's other technologies? Well, most of the scientific community doesn't know. And they think they're really smart, you see. And they think they're so much smarter than everybody else. But in point of fact, they've been lied to throughout their entire educational path. And so they think, they really sincerely believe, a lot of them are really good people who sincerely believe that nuclear is the best alternative to creating more fossil fuels. But they're told that there's no such thing as zero point, you see. So I don't want to just demonize a group of people either. I want to say that there are some people, and it's a very, very, very small group of people who are aware of all these things, okay, who are aware of most of it at least, and their implementation of it can only be considered parasitic, their implication of all their policies. Why is it that we're fighting these wars constantly? Why is it that trillions of dollars of debt are being accumulated in the destruction of planet Earth? When you invest in life, the payback is life. when you invest, both of my grandfathers, actually strange to say, but the first one of my grandfathers told me, we were out in a field that he had, and he said, take this seed and plant it in the ground. And he said, that's the greatest investment you'll ever make. Because that one seed will become a plant of corn. And that plant of corn will produce thousands of seeds. He says, think of what the return on your investment is. He says, yes, there are hard years. There's years where there's too much rain. There's too little rain. But net-net, an agricultural economy is an abundant economy. And that's what we had before the military-industrial complex, the global corporate hegemony, whatever appellation, again, we give it. Before this alien parasitic force took over and seized control of our planet, we were sovereign on the basis of our agriculture. Our agriculture. My father grew up on a dairy farm. That part of my family in Vermont and New Hampshire had some of the largest dairy farms in either state. And beautiful, I mean, just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful places with really happy, contented cows where you drank the milk and you felt good afterwards, you know? And it was like, and you were out in the sun baling hay or whatever you were doing. It was a different way to live. And all of a sudden, we went from there, where the majority of people in Canada, the United States, were still living on farms, to what we have now, where the majority of the people are living in urban centers and being poisoned daily, being given fluoride in their water to make them more passive, being entrained through television and radio, and just electromagnetically, without even, see, you can turn off your television and tell your kids to turn off the television, but the entrainment is happening through the airwaves. Electromagnetically, through right. The ground wave transmission system and through HARP and other broadcast, you have to remember these are the most powerful broadcast stations in the world. We're talking about broadcast stations which broadcast, like HARP, let's say 100 megawatts is broadcast into the ionosphere. And we create what's called a resonant domain there. And the resonant domain there is a multiplicative capacitive environment. In other words, the signal, let's say a gigawatt. The signal is actually amplified 1,000 times, so it becomes a terawatt, a rebroadcast. And because you have an articulating array, you can direct that rebroadcast towards specific areas within the footprint of the re-radiation footprint of HARP. Okay, and HARP is only one of these devices. Remember, these devices are all over the world now. This is right out of the Matrix. You know, rewatch right. The Matrix. Rewatch the Matrix Revisited. Rewatch it. And you'll see the very interesting thing. It's kind of like this stuff leaks through the media as science fiction, but in point of fact, it's actually what's happening. And it really is happening, you know? People are really being dumbed down. I have a very intelligent friend, or former friend, of a Johns Hopkins engineer who lives in Maryland. I won't name him. But he is absolutely convinced that I have lost my, I'm totally out of my mind because I'm saying that Fukushima Daiichi is a threat to all the human species and all the species on planet Earth. He's totally ignoring the facts. He's totally buying into the lies that are being told by the Japanese government and by TEPCO, which we are refuting every day. And it's just like there's lie after lie, after like the Gulf of Mexico disaster. The same kind of lies were being told and being countenanced by the Obama administration, which is supposed to be about change. And God damn them for doing that, you see? And I mean that. I mean that literally. I pray that the most powerful power of all powers stops these things, these people, these companies. Because what's happening at Fukushima right now, as you and I are speaking, Scott, all these months later, since March, we have a triple China syndrome meltdown. We have a quadruple meltdown, but we have a triple China syndrome meltdown. I'm not sure at all that number 4 hasn't gone China syndrome, but I know 1, 2, and 3 have gone China syndrome. We know the ground around there is cracking because we got a leak. Somebody leaked this information, got this information out of there. Right. And it's not hyperbole from some blog, you know. We are measuring plutonium-239 all over the world, including Perry Station in Antarctica, okay? I know this from the best source, This is not from some pseudoscientist writing on YouTube and distracting people with his bullshit, okay? These are real scientists who are the most cynical and skeptical guys you could possibly imagine in some ways. They work for they work in the nuclear industry. They work in nuclear testing. They have access to the most broad spectrum radiation monitoring network worldwide. And they're the ones who are saying it's reached peristation. This is 39 terabecquerels of plutonium-239 are being released. That's 39 trillion decay moments every day just of that one isotope from that site. And there was only one reactor, and that was reactor number 3 that had plutonium in it in the mixed oxide environment. Now we've got these things, full-blown China syndrome, melting into the earth. The earth is cracking around the plant. This is not a joke.
Right. Fukushima, just because it's out of the mainstream media, Fukushima doesn't mean it's over.
Fukushima, oh, are you kidding me? It's worse than it ever has been before. I mean, what do you think happened there? Everybody just wants to conveniently go. I mean, I can't believe this friend of mine, this former friend of mine, I still consider him my friend. I know he's been entrained. I know he's been sublimized, just like the rest of the population, to be kind of like, oh, well, don't talk to me about UFOs. Ha, ha, ha. Don't talk to me about Fukushima. Don't talk to me about Zero Point. It's like it's all partitioned in people's psyches this way so that the people who are killing us, literally, can get away with it. And I don't know why. You know, you could say they're aliens and they're just exploiting the crap out of the resources until they're finished destroying the planet, which is what it looks like is happening. You could say that. But whether they're actually aliens from another world who are doing this, or it's just an agenda that's alien to the good of all life, it doesn't really matter, does it? They're parasites.
Right.
And we need to exorcise them from our political systems. We need to exorcise them from our academic systems. We need to exorcise them from our corporate systems. It's not that all corporations are bad, but we need to have a different modus operandi. We need to have a modus operandi that allows for not just my technologies, but the spectrum of technologies that people have invented before they were murdered. Okay, like Ed Gray, my dear friend Ed Gray, who invented beautiful technologies, beautiful multiplicative technologies, 10 times, 20 times more power coming out than they used. Yeah, okay, we in terms of multipliers, we went beyond that, but not in terms of practically applicable technology. You know, we did have a 28 kilowatt magnetic generator that was in Scottsdale at one time that got confiscated or disappeared at any rate, let's put it that way, that was 60 hertz cycle compatible, that didn't require any outside fuel source, you know, and we could have been 50 hertz cycle adapted easily. And there was a guy actually, and it was kind of, and there's like the old Hubbard machine that was in popular science. If you can figure out what the energy product of a real rare earth magnet is, and it's enormous what you can exploit in terms of those kind of generators. And Ed Gray didn't even use that. Ed Gray used electromagnets, but arrayed in a specific kind of way with a spark gap that really changed the dynamics of the system. I mean, and he was murdered. I mean, I know he was murdered. He was my friend. And I know who killed him. And it's like...
And that was Edwin Gray.
Ed Gray.
Yeah.
And
how many of your technologies were confiscated or you got sidetracked on?
Well, let me put it this way. What year was that? 1993 or 1994, Henry Landsman, Hank, Uncle Hank, came out from Ames at NASA. This is a guy who didn't even like to take vacations. He was beyond retirement age, but he continued on as a consultant and arrived at work at 5:30 every morning out there. And he flew out and he said, Adam, the person you're working with is a milk machine. And I said, what do you mean? He says, he's a milk machine. They're milking you for your ideas. They want to get you on the phone and get you talking because every time you talk, you're like revealing a new technology, a new idea. These people are bereft of ideas, and so they need to get them somewhere. And so they've got you in this kind of dialogue with this person, and he's a milk machine. And I said, no, he's not. He's a brilliant fucking engineer. Pardon my language, but that's what I said. And he said, no, actually, you may think he's a brilliant. I said, no, he is actually really a brilliant engineer. He may be also a milk machine, either intentionally or unintentionally. I do not know, but he's also a brilliant engineer. And he says, that being said, I can say this. You have an extraordinary IQ. You're an incredibly intelligent person. But in terms of social IQ, not so smart at all. He said, because you're being parasitized. And I said, the whole planet's being parasitized. You know that. Of all the people I know, you know that. You know these things. You know these back-engineered technologies exist where we have our own little flying discs flying around. You know, thank you, Martin Marietta, or Ashley. Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm using old names. But, you know, Lockheed Martin, for example. You know, we have our own technologies that we've reversed engineered from a more intelligent species, but we haven't evolved, you see, as a species enough until we actually are really being human. We're not even human yet. You know, we are devolving because of our doping. You know, it's like you depress the hell out of people with bad news every night, and then you feed them antidepressants and you make trillions of dollars off of them. You feed them fluoride so they become impotent, and then you give them Viagra and other erectile dysfunction medications. And you tell me that's not organized crime? Don't tell me that's not organized crime. That is organized crime. That is the essence of organized crime. There's never been more organized crime. This makes Al Capone look like a total jerk amateur, what these guys are doing, you know? Pretty Boy Floyd, all those guys who were supposed to be crooks back there during the Great Depression. The fact of the matter is the real criminals are the ones who are putting fluoride in your water and selling you Viagra. The ones who are feeding you a spectrum of carcinogens in your water and then bankrupting you, as in the United States, at least they're bankrupting people, as you get not cured from cancer more often than not, you know? And so if they get a 20% cure rate with a drug, they think it's a great thing. Thank you, Eli. You know, it's like, give me a break. You know, we know that there are better treatments. We know that there are better ways to approach this. We know that we have infinitely abundant energy that requires no fuel, that creates no pollution, and doesn't have to create bad electromagnetic noise. We know that every single household on this planet, in third world countries and in first world countries alike, could have their own power source in the back of their hovel or in the back of their mansion. And by the time you're done with it and you calculate the cost of this parasitic energy economy on the planet and on the human species, you would have enough to spread around so that basically everybody, not in some kind of Marxist, communist, or Maoist nonsense, communist kind of environment, but in a collective abundance where instead of sharing scarcity, and parceling out the field in that way, that we are actually sharing in universal abundance. That's what an intelligent species does. And the species on the main who come here, not all of them, I don't think, but the species on the main who come here, some of whom have been trying to help, who have evolved beyond this kind of really primitive state, want to say, hey, you know, this is all based on a lie.
Right.
You don't have to get on that train and go to Auschwitz. You could. It makes more sense for you to grab the fucking gun and shoot the son of a bitch. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, see, I don't believe in violent revolutions. I don't believe violent revolutions really produce the results usually, because usually the people who run violent revolutions are morons, quite honestly.
Well, what usually ends up happening is the people that want to fight the power, that they run a revolution, and then they get into power, and they end up being the tyrant, more of a tyrant than the guy they deposed.
Yeah, vis-a-vis China right now, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union formerly, you know, where you had the whole Politburo elite, and they were, you know, they were living in the mansions right after the Bolshevik Revolution would be occupied by Chapitchman. I don't want people having to go into the mansions. I want, you know, I loved what Jesus said. My father's house has many mansions. I mean, I'm talking about universal abundance. I'm not talking about some people having abundance and other people not having abundance. I'm not talking about inverting the scales or blaming people who happen to be creative and successful sometimes, and that's why they have money. I'm not talking about tormenting them like the French did, okay, in their revolution. I don't want to decry the French Revolution too much, but it was a bloody friggin' mess that left the inmates in charge of the asylum. You know, I mean, just like, you know, excuse me. And that liberalism has allowed the invasion, just like the liberalism here is involved in. And we have the greatest invasion in human history that has occurred with nearly a shot in the United States. And now the United States, Canada, and Mexico want to talk to us about this grand new union of the three nations. Give me a break. They have parasites that are running rampant in Mexico that they're not treating, that aren't identified. My daughter almost died of one of these called neurocysticercosis, and I'd never heard of it. But guess what? It's the leading cause of seizures in the world. It's the leading cause of epilepsy in the world. And it's frequently not diagnosed even in the United States. They diagnose somebody as being epileptic and start putting them on phenobarb or some other drug. And all the time they've got these eggs that are a centimeter to 2 centimeters to even more that are actually the natal sacs of pig tapeworms.
Okay.
And the eggs of pig tapeworms. 70 to 80% of all the people coming across the border legally and illegally are infected with this, and nobody even knows about it because this guy at Center for Disease Control says they don't want vigilantism. But, you know, this is showing up in the Orthodox Jewish community in New York City even. It's showing, I mean, because those people who are hired to prepare the dinner on Sabbath are contaminated. And this can be cured, it can be healed, but nobody's doing a damn thing about it. Because we have these fruits of Bill Clinton's NAFTA, not just Bill Clinton's NAFTA, but the entire NAFTA mentality. Which basically allowed for major corporations to go and exploit the water resources in Mexico to the point where they pumped out the aquifers so that 78% of the people in Mexico do not have potable water. Of course, now the standard of living is so much lower in the United States that we have millions, we literally are having hundreds of thousands of people going back to Mexico, to the point where the governor of the state of Sonora, in Mexico, wrote the governor of the state of Arizona and said, we can't handle all these Mexicans that are coming back from the United States. This is a true story. That just happened about a year ago.
Now, you see reflections of this just a little bit. When you look on, well, you won't see it on the mainstream news. Good luck with that. But the Occupy Wall Street has now become,
yes,
Occupy Chicago,
yes,
Occupy Detroit,
yes,
Occupy, Occupy, Occupy.
How is it that the people who stole all of these trillions of dollars have gotten away with it? How is it that the Obama administration, which claimed it represented change, has been nothing but the little marionette? It's an embarrassment to Martin Luther King that Barack Obama is the kind of president that he is. He should be ashamed of himself for allowing this to continue, and then Eric Holder and Senator, I won't even name, I mean, I know one of the senators that's involved in this, and it's definitely a conspiracy because I actually heard this person talking about it. And I know these people sending these firearms, fully automatic weapons across the border, weapons that I can't buy as an American citizen, it doesn't matter. I mean, you cannot, unless I get a Class 3 permit, which is not easy to get at that level, I'll tell you that much. And so they were sending these weapons across and saying, aha, they're going to come back across the border and we're going to track them and we're going to say, aha, look at these were weapons that started out in the United States. And they thought that they could disguise the fact that they were the ones who sent them down there. You see, because right, they don't want the population to be armed, because the reason, as my grandfather said, the Second Amendment exists in the United States Constitution is because somebody has to be there to protect the First Amendment, which is the freedom of expression. And of course, you're in Canada, so you have a little different set of rules up there. But right, the fact of the matter is, look at the tyrannies and look at the messes that are created by these tyrannies. Lebanon, you know, absolutely, guy who's absolutely Looney Tune, megalomaniac, nutcase, obviously a nutcase for years, being kowtowed to by Canada, by the United States, by all these European countries, by these countries in the United Nations who are really basically not doing their jobs. How are we going to replace these people? How are we going to do it? You know, people don't even have the political will to get out of bed in the morning without taking their Prozac. You know, I mean, it's a very difficult situation. And I'm just praying. And you know what? Whatever happens, I would rather. It's better to die fighting the good fight. It's better to die with integrity than to live without it.
The only problem with that is, it's generally the elite structure that's telling you and your children what the good fight is. They're convincing you through propaganda what the good fight is.
They're not telling me what the good fight is.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but they're not telling anybody what the good fight is. Really, they're really not showing anybody how to save this planet. They're lying through their bloody teeth. I mean, you know, the one thing that's interesting is that John Holdren, who's now the head of science and technology for the White House, I feel so sorry for him under this administration. I had big hopes for him because he's extremely brilliant. And he's also very eccentric, but he's a very smart guy. And he and colleagues of his had realized before he was put in that position that solar and wind cannot replace fossil fuels. I mean, you know, there are people who have these kind of hypothetical models, you know, of how quickly this could happen. It doesn't happen in time. I mean, the reason that I'm out here, I mean, believe me, I would rather stay in retreat. And, you know, I think I've told you, I was in retreat for years.
Yeah.
Trying to recover from cancer.
But the reason you're beating the drum, I mean, you've come out in this movie, Thrive, talking about free energy and the access to it. The reason you're beating the drum now is because you feel a sense of urgency. Well, not for yourself.
It's not just that I feel a sense of urgency, but all the data says it's there. And these guys who call themselves scientists who say this is not an emergency and an urgent situation, and that we have decades to sit around in a circle and, you know, I don't want to be crude. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is they're liars. A lot of them are liars. This is an emergency. This is a serious emergency. And I know that just as sure as I say this, I'm going to be attacked. Every time I say this, I get attacked. I get anathematized. I get marginalized. But you show me one of these sons of guns out there who said what Project Earth said in 1985. You show me one of these groups that predicted the increase in wind velocities, even though there's actually a scientist who's saying that the winds aren't increasing their velocity. I mean, just turn on the news, you know? And, you know, they say that there hasn't been an increase in tornadic activity. You show me any evidence of consecutive mile-wide tornadoes happening in 1950. I mean, believe me, we have scoured the records, you know?
Right.
And not only this, but just a few years ago, it was publicly acknowledged in the scientific literature that we had increasing numbers of tornadoes. You know, and now they want to pretend that this, and they base these statistics, and that's Chad Myers on CNN, who seems like a nice enough fellow, you know, and he's just mimicking, he's just miming, he's just talking bullshit that somebody has told him, you know, somebody who he considers to be in a position of authority. Shame on them. We Right. do have increases in wind velocities. We have increases in destructive climate activity worldwide. Hell, I was in Austria lecturing a couple of years ago, and we were driving to Salzburg on our next stop, and actually, we had just driven to Salzburg, and we were settling into our hotel in Salzburg, turned on the news, and on the Austrian broadcast, they were talking about two tornadoes, actually, that had happened in Austria. They had to explain to people what tornadoes were.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know? It was like, it's not only in Kansas anymore, Dorothy.
Right.
You know, it's worldwide. It's in Hawaii.
So what do you think about the Canary Islands?
We have tornadoes in the Hawaiian Islands, you know. We have tornadoes happening because we've changed the molecular structure of the atmosphere. We've increased the molar density and the size of these macromolecular change. We've created this. It's got a different viscosity than it used to have. The shear constants and coefficients have all changed, you know? And this is something that is not a joke. This is something that is actually really happening. And sure, the liars can lie and pretend and say, oh, go back to sleep. here, we have a better antidepressant for you this month. It won't make you feel suicidal. I have a friend here in Aspen, just a wonderful guy, just turned 50. And he just changed his antidepressant and committed suicide last week. And, you know, and it's on the warning label. It's in the contraindications for both antidepressants that either one of them can cause suicidal tendencies to be greatly magnified. It can actually cause you to commit suicide.
Wow.
And so it's like this has got to stop. And so the reason Thrive is coming out is not just talking about Adam Trombley. It's talking about a bunch of different people. There's a whole bunch of people that are interviewed. I'm only a small part of this movie, but it's about this revolution that needs to happen. It's a movement. When Foster Gamble came to my house on Maui in January 1st, 2005, and talked to me about making this movie, because he came and he says, I'm going to make this movie. And I looked like I was going to die. I had a six-month prognosis at the time. And he said, we got to get you on camera before you die. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. Obviously, I didn't die, number one, and it's taken all these years since that conversation for this to actually finally come out. And it's because, and it's amazing testimony to his tenacity, to his wife Kimberly's tenacity, to the tenacity of all the people involved in the project, in spite of some considerable resistance from family and other people, no doubt. And I really don't have the full inside scoop on that, because basically we have very limited communication, because all my communications are not private. So
right. So you had an interview with them.
You and I haven't been interrupted in this. There's been a couple of weird noise things that you've heard, but we haven't been interrupted, thanks be to God, in this whole conversation. We haven't been shut down like we were the first time we attempted to do this interview. And not once. The power hasn't gone off at your house. Not once. Okay.
It happened last time, yeah.
And it happened last time. And people don't know about that because that interview never got broadcast because of some other issues. But the fact of the matter is that we are still here, and this movie is coming out. And I recommend that everybody, it's being broadcast in 9 languages on the internet, $5 a pop worldwide. And I recommend that everybody tell everybody about it, and you watch the whole thing. I haven't even seen the whole thing yet. So I'm saying this with a little danger, because I haven't seen the whole thing yet. Maybe it eventually says, well, you know, we think this guy's a nutcase or something. I don't think that's what it says, though. But I'm just kidding about that, I think. But the fact is that I know for a fact that is not the message. The message
and you were specifically interviewed about free energy.
Free energy, my own history.
Your inventions.
Why we did Project Earth, when we realized how great the emergency on Earth is. I mean, we have an ozone layer that basically is profoundly degraded, and they're acting like, you know, Al Gore's out there. Al Gore actually is counterproductive. I can't even believe these guys gave him the Nobel Prize. He actually tried to convince people that the Montreal Protocols worked. You know, and that's just, and the Kyoto protocols are working or something. It's a disingenuous statement at best. Okay. Has anything improved at all as a result? Yeah, probably. Things are not as bad as they would have been. But ameliorating is different from remediating. Okay. Pacifying is different from curing. Okay. Al Gore, I came up to me in tears at Johns Hopkins University in an auditorium lecture I gave in 1988. And in tears, I mean, said it was the most inspiring thing he'd ever heard. What could he do to help? And then he went on retreat at another friend of mine from Maryland's retreat center and began working on Earth and the Balance, where my lectures are verbatim quoted, but you won't find my name in the bibliography. Okay? The man doesn't really know the science altogether, you see? And it makes the science he espouses sometimes very vulnerable. Like, I was the only one in the world who was talking about the decrease in oxygen in the equatorial chimney, because we have this thing called the equatorial convergence zone in the atmosphere, because it's the equator. It's the greatest acceleration, of course, it's 1,000 miles an hour, basically. That's how fast you're traveling when you're on the equator. As you go up towards the north or the south, you're traveling slower and slower because the circle gets smaller and smaller, right? So the amount of distance you're actually covering is smaller in that hour. But at the equator, where you have this maximum velocity, you actually have this kind of thing we call the equatorial convergence zone. And it's a chimney that carries the oxygen from the equatorial rainforests and the oceans up into the stratosphere, into the through the tropopause, through the thermocline area between the troposphere and the stratosphere, right up into the stratosphere, where it becomes, guess what? What does O2 become when it goes into the ozone, into the stratosphere? I already answered the question by accident. It becomes ozone. O2 becomes O3. Okay? And so without the O2 being constantly supplied into the stratosphere, this is not an Aristotelian crystalline sphere. Again, without the O2 being constantly supplied into the stratosphere, you get no O3. Okay? So you destroy the equatorial, over 50% of the equatorial rainforests that existed when I was 18 years old have been destroyed. Okay? So we've lost huge amounts of oxygen production. And there's these cynical scientists who say, but, you know, we won't die of anoxia, you know, because, you know, even if you burned all the carbon fuels on Earth, you know, you still wouldn't consume enough oxygen to suffocate you. Well, you know, there's been several anoxic events that have happened in different major cities where the oxygen tension in the atmosphere in Tokyo and Beijing and New York City even has gone down at different pollution events. We know this is again the industrial complex corporate lie. You know, it's like, go back to sleep. Those aren't really gas chambers, they're showers. You know, we're just going to clean the lights off of you. You know, it's like this is the mentality. And why and who, what kind of species would do that? In the first place, if these are people who are actually supposed to be a part of our own species, then obviously we need to build new prisons, okay? Because these are the guys who are committing mass murder. These are the serial killers, okay? Right. These are the guys who get us used to drones going into villages, who get us used to drones coming into our own towns someday, you see? When the insurgencies happen, what do you think they're going to use these technologies to suppress? We're going to have our little AK-47s or whatever we have, or 50 caliber Barretts, you know, and they're going to have drones. Okay?
Right.
Seriously. You know, do you think these guys are going to let go of power easily? So I have to say, we can power our own movement, not violent revolution. So we're calling in Thrive, as we have in Project Earth since the inception of Project Earth, when Bucky and I first conceived of it. We were calling for a movement in humanity, a movement, you know, where people join together for the sake of future generations. And they put their lives on the line, like the people who started the United States Revolution, the American Revolution. They put their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness on the line. These were the wealthiest people. Mount Vernon was not a shack, okay? Monticello, you know? Look at where these guys lived. Do you think these guys were the poor people having a Marxist revolution? No. The tyranny was usurping their properties if they spoke out, you see?
Right.
The tyranny of King George and his courtiers, you know? And we were saved by Louis who was then overthrown by the maniacs who overthrew him, Jean-Paul Marat and people like that. If it hadn't been for the king of France, the United States wouldn't exist because he gave us the money for the armaments and some of the armaments. I mean, this is the history really needs to be told. It's in the history books. I mean, it's there, but people are lazy. They're pacified sometimes, and they need to get
angry. They're highly entertained.
Yeah, they're highly entertained. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, why, how was it they discovered that all these things had passed through the SEC in the United States? They discovered most of these guys were watching porn on the internet. I mean, this is literally true. There's a study this is literally true. This is certified testimony before Congress. And when you find out what really happened in the atmosphere, it'll be the same friggin' thing. Scientists on coffee break. We call them coffee break scientists. When the USGS and when the head of the USGS Earthquake Center in Golden said in response to reporters' questions when we forecast the Scotts Mill quake in Oregon, how we did it, he said it was just a fluke, and he said it was impossible to do because they didn't do it. You see? So it was impossible to do. Those people didn't do it. But I know people who were working for the USGS at the time who were completely capable of doing it, who had as good of instruments as I had, and weren't allowed to do it. They weren't allowed to make a public. And then there was another guy from the USGS who goes around to this day claiming that he made the forecast when we called the USGS and told him that this was going to happen, and he said it was impossible. And there's this guy running around saying that he made the forecast about Loma Prieta back in 1989. This is the kind of weird stuff that happens in our world.
Okay.
Where, you know, people basically of mediocre minds make claims for ideas that they never had. And therefore, they're never properly, no policy can be properly implemented on the basis of what Al Gore says, because even though he knows zero point is real, he doesn't ever talk about it. He doesn't have the courage to talk about it because he's too busy making $300 million from the green economy,
right.
the fake green economy. We have an alternative energy
carbon taxes. Yeah,
we have
all invest in carbon taxes for years and then bring it out as a great idea.
Right, exactly. And then when the hegemony decides that they want to acknowledge the presence of alien life or they want to acknowledge zero point, they'll claim that they invented it like it's a new idea instead of an idea that's over 100 years old. It would be just as disingenuous for me to sit here and tell you and your listeners that I invented this, you know. I've invented seven different generations, seven different types with coworkers, colleagues. I've co-invented a piezo ringing resonance generator, which uses piezo crystals and materials made with piezo crystals to create multiples, what we call quantum pumps, to create multiples of what we put into it by creating condensate moments, electron condensate moments out of the background field that then inductively couple into to a coil and then become actual electrons with temporal integrity, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been doing this for years, and there's people inside the United States government at Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore. I could go on and on and on. And I know there's people in Canada who've been doing this for years and years and years, but you don't hear about it.
No.
And it's like, excuse me, where is the validity of your credential?
Right.
Okay, Mr. I mean, I'm a professor. I have credentials, but I'm out there. What Bucky said to me one day, he says, you know what? You're kind of neurotic about all that stuff. He said, your ultimate credential will be, Adam, the validity of your work 25 years from now, 30 years from now. That will be your greatest credential, you see? And I can point to 25 years ago saying what would be happening in the atmosphere right now. I can point to 25 years ago saying what would be happening in the ozone layer right now. I could say 25 years ago what would be happening with winds and tornadoes. Okay? This is a legal issue. Okay? I can definitely meet the rules of evidence in a court of law.
Right.
Okay? And the thing is, so they want to create doublethink, Orwellian doublethink. Just tell people it ain't so, but don't even tell people it ain't so. Just say, like when Wolf Blitzer asks his meteorologist on the Situation Room, and Wolf is a really good journalist, by the way, really, really bright guy. I mean, for real, this guy is a very smart man. And I'm sure probably Myers is a very smart guy too, but they work for Time Warner, for Christ's sakes. You know, I mean, what this once guerrilla news organization that was great, was a wonderful group of people run by Ted Turner, has, you know, was sold out, was totally sold out. And so now they're constrained. Now Anderson Cooper has to stand there in Tokyo with Sanjay Gupta, et cetera, and the rest of his group. And so with Sanjay saying, look at, we're only being exposed to this mass radiation, only to discover that those things are over an order of magnitude out of calibration, that little instrument he's holding up, and they were intentionally put out of calibration. And believe me, Sanjay Gupta and Cooper and those guys got the hell out of Tokyo quickly, because Tokyo is not a safe place to be. We've got tens of millions of Japanese and Chinese at this point who have been exposed to fatal doses of radiation. The way this works isn't that you just drop dead like in Kurosawa's dreams, where he has this nightmare about all the six reactors going into meltdown at the same time and criticality event causing people to breathe the air and suddenly drop dead in a couple seconds. You know, that's not the way this works. I was exposed to radiation in 1974. Okay, I was exposed to a lot of radiation doing soil samples in a dairy farm outside of Boulder, Colorado, in Broomfield, Colorado, one of the largest dairy farms that happened to feed into the largest local dairy in Boulder called Watts Hardy Dairy. And we were dumb. We didn't even wear dust masks or anything. We went out there with Ace Hardware trowels and baggies and dug up this stuff that was deposition from an 8-kilogram fire that had happened in May of 1969 at Rocky Flats, which was a nuclear trigger plant for nuclear warheads. And they had they had an event where somebody poked a hole into their glove, oxygen got in, the stuff combusted. And so we were digging in this soil because I'd had this weird intuition walking by this farm with my brother-in-law, who he and my sister lived in this condo right across the parking lot from this field. And they thought it was great to have a dairy field there because, you know, we were raised to love cows. I just had this intuition. I had this weird sensation walking by the field, and I could see the top of the Rocky Flats water tower, which I didn't even know was Rocky Flats water tower. I had no idea what had happened there in 1969. I was just in school, okay? And so we take these samples, and when the analysis is finally done, we got 10,000 to over 80,000 times permissible, so-called permissible, whatever a permissible level of plutonium is, one molecule in one alveolar sac in your lung will cause lung cancer, you know, one molecule. Okay, we have trillions of molecules going into the atmosphere every day, trillions of molecules. And they say, oh, there's plutonium so heavy, it's just going to fall out. Well, it will precipitate out, but a lot of it's getting up into the stratosphere. A lot of it's getting up into the trade winds. A lot of it's getting up into these currents of air that move around the planet, enough so that they measure it in Scotland and France and Germany and Austria now, enough so that we measure it all the way in the Southern Hemisphere at Antarctica. Okay, so we're talking about a global mutagenic event caused by one nuclear power plant. One nuclear power plant in full China syndrome meltdown, which is being obfuscated, which is being hidden. And every one of those reporters on CNN and CBC and all of the networks throughout the planet, every one of those reporters who participate in this lie, saying that this isn't real and isn't happening, are helping to destroy their own children's children's children. We're going to have people who have, you know, I mean, I'm talking about Hieronymus Bosch grotesquerie, deformation, deformity. You know, we've never had, there's nothing in the rock record. I was talking to somebody at one of our leading geophysical observatories in this country the other day, and I can't name this person, but I said, is there anything that you know in any of the stratigraphy, any of the analysis of the different strata from core samples, ice cores or rock cores, is there any layer where we have these kind of isotopes showing up? And of course, the answer is no. Or we have the byproducts of these kind of isotopes? And the answer is no. This is an unprecedented catastrophe, just that event. And that's only one thing that's going on. The ongoing catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico, where now people are saying, everybody says, well, the FDA says the fish is safe. And we have the highest incidence of food poisoning in the history of the United States. Okay? Because 70% of the seafood that people consume here comes from the Gulf of Mexico. And British Petroleum just gets to pretend that this capping of this riser, that my dear friend Matt Simmons was murdered because he was one of the world's leading experts in underwater oil infrastructure. He was an oil and gas guy who had gotten into alternative energy. And he still owns Simmons Corporation down there. And he was forced to resign as the chairman because of his statements that were on CNN, MSNBC, Bloomberg, et cetera, et cetera. Wonderful guy, extremely, extremely intelligent guy. And he just said, Adam, it's a riser. It's not the thing that they're showing on TV with all the oil coming out of it. It's only a riser, a pressure relief riser coming off the main well. He says that was a 5-story metal building that was blown off of there over a mile away from the crater where it was blown off, underwater, a mile and a half underwater. It was.
What does that mean?
That means there's still a crater down there and that the South Mississippi Canyon off the United States of America and the Gulf of Mexico still got oil coming out into it. And this stuff is rising up and they're saying, oh, it's a new leak. It's remote from the other well, you know, they're lying and lying and lying and lying. They wouldn't let Anderson Cooper. They wouldn't let any of the reporters from the CBC. They wouldn't let anybody have unbridled access to the Gulf of Mexico when this thing was in the peak of the crisis. Because and then Barack Obama goes down there and gets in the water, okay, to show that it's safe. I wouldn't send my enemy into that water because this stuff happens over time. What I was trying to say is the people who are exposed because of Fukushima aren't going to die tomorrow, most of them, unless they've received extraordinary close proximity exposure. They're going to die over the next 5 or 10 years. You know, the cancer in this body didn't show up for 9 years after my exposure. At least that was when we discovered the first tumor, the first right. lesion. And that's the way this works. And this is why it's an emergency that we demand our governments, the Canadian government, the United States government, the Russian government, the German government, the Chinese government, the Japanese government, the people of this planet need to rise up and say, we've reached the zero point. You know, we have reached the zero point, which means that we have to start using it. You have zero credibility with us.
Right.
We have zero tolerance for you continuing to destroy this planet and making our lives miserable. We're tired of our kids coming back from school discontent and stupid, barely literate. Read the history of Rome. By the time Rome fell, the legions were illiterate. This is the truth. You can read history. If you read history, it's a remarkable thing. I'm not a historian, but I'm a reader of history. And it's just like unbelievable when you actually read it. You know, I mean, I'm vociferously reading all the time. You never, ever, I don't care if you have your triple postdoctorate, never stop your education. I don't care if you only have a high school credential or not even that, never stop learning. You see, you can educate yourself. You have the greatest resource for education that's ever existed in the history of this world. We have very little time. Get on the internet and use it. And don't right. listen. And don't listen to idiots who tell you that their survival kit includes a gallon or 5 gallons of water and you're going to throw it in the back of your Toyota and drive up and somewhere and survive. Okay? And they're telling you that HAARP is creating all these earthquakes. It's just, that's nonsense. I can't remember the guy's name right now, what he calls himself. But it's total bullshit. See, these guys make my life and the life of all the scientists that I know who are trying to warn humanity and help humanity, they make our lives very difficult. You know, nutcases make our lives very difficult, okay?
Or they're just working with their own agenda.
And they're working with their own agenda because they're getting millions of hits on YouTube, you know? And it's like, and they're living in their poverty. And all of a sudden they got, you know, I have been poor in my life. I haven't always been wealthy. Okay. I was cut off entirely. I mean, before by certain government forces, I was cut off by my own family at one point. And so, I mean, I worked as a janitor in college. I do actually know what it is to have nothing and to have to work so that I can survive. I'm not one of those people who can speak as someone who's never had that experience. Thank God, actually, because I feel like a lot of my education would be invalid otherwise. And so I also have everything to lose in terms of the stuff that people normally value, including this life. But again, we have to have a movement. The Thrive Movement, if that's what somebody wishes to call it, that's what Foster's chosen to call it. Project Earth is what Bucky and I called it 40 years ago. The whole thing is all the same thing. We need an expression of life. How can you expect intervention from higher intelligence if you don't demonstrate any intelligence? Okay? It's like the guy's not going to hit you with the paddles to give you, you know, to get your heart beating again if you're already decayed.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? If you can smell the decomp in the room, they don't take the panels to you. And this whole planet stinks to high heaven of decomp. I mean, literally of decomp.
Yeah.
Literally of death and destruction. And we need to change that picture. We can change that picture. And we need to demand leadership that is willing to implement it. And I don't care if these guys say they're mea culpas and make a sincere apology, fine. A sincere apology is like what Jesus said to the woman who was caught in adultery. He said, go and sin no more. That's what we all have to do. None of us are immune. None of us are the most saintly saints, you know? None of us are perfectly, nobody. I mean, when somebody said to Jesus, you're perfect, I mean, these Christians kill me. These people who call themselves Christians kill me, who think that they're saved vicariously through the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, what you have to do is love one another as I love you. Then it can be on earth as it is in heaven. That's the incarnation of the Lord's Prayer, not kneeling down on your knees and repeating this mantrically, verbally, rhetorically all the time. It's doing that. It's loving one another. It's getting into the trenches. It's loving your children enough to get off your asses and go to Toronto, go to Vancouver, and say to the people who are shooting you with rubber bullets and gassing you, if that's what it takes. It's a getting on the internet, getting on the telephone and saying, we need 0 point. But the most effective thing is to do this as a political movement. I believe we have almost no time to do this. And I believe the violent revolution, the violent insurgencies, which are already occurring worldwide, even in China, which you're hearing very little about, by the way. There's a violent insurgency occurring in certain areas of China right now. There's violent insurgencies occurring in Russia right now because the hegemony has not taken into account the impact of stratification, that there's a certain point where the mass of humanity's quality of life degrades to the point where they would rather die than continue to live this humiliation.
So the quantum entanglement is the information is passing all around the earth. Maybe that's the reason happening.
Absolutely. And they see, and then on the other side, on the bright side, Thrive is actually coming out, but we have to demand that it actually is allowed to come out. It's not a cure for anything. It's just information, for God's sakes. And you need more and more of this information. We need to educate the public. We need to re-educate the public. We need money to do that. You know, these guys like Gates and Jobs, and, you know, I Gates spent time at our booth at Comdex for one of my companies in 1983, an hour and a half. I mean, Jobs was a great guy in the early days, you know, in the transition from, you know, the old, you know, primitive Apple operating system into Lisa, incorporating Smalltalk from Xerox and into Macintosh. I was around a lot at Apple at the time as a consultant. And I can tell you, we need that kind of creative mentality that was happening at Apple at that time, that kind of rebellious attitude that made the Super Bowl commercial with the guy throwing the hammer into the icon of corporate America, you know, saying this is the computer for the rest of us. Well, this is the technology for the rest of us. The rest of us are the majority of us, by the way. This is the technology for the
99%.
99%. And I'm not talking about even 99. I'm talking about 99.9% even. Because it's really, people don't understand the people who are really running this thing is a very small group of people. I know very rich people who are billionaires. I mean, I know quite a few of them actually in my life. And they don't know it. They haven't known it. I sit down and talk to them. And they say, well, I didn't know that. And then they go to their science advisors and their science advisors tell them, like back in the 90s, their science advisors tell them, well, that's bullshit. You know, that's just not true. It's not what's happening. And now I'm getting these calls, see, or I'm walking down the street and these guys come up to me and say, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? Holy crap, everything you said was going to happen is happening. You know? And I say, yeah, it's not mine. I don't own that. I mean, I own it in the sense that I'm responsible for disseminating it, you know, but it's not like I'm not a German shepherd. I don't territorialize infinity. You know, this is like all water from the same aquifer. Here's a glass of it. You know, that doesn't make me the source of the water. That's why the guru thing has got to go.
Right.
Screw the guru model. I had a really dear friend of mine who went totally crackers, megalomaniac, you know, thought he was the giver of life. He was a wonderful, brilliant guy. But because he was surrounded by a bunch of people who wanted to be moths around a flame, you know, he eventually became convinced of his own hegemony, his own megalomaniac hegemony, that he was the guy. He was the very God that people wanted. What bullshit. Jesus Christ never said shit like that. It was Saul of Tarsus the heretic, who everybody, you know, goes around talking about being the great apostle. You can see these short circuits, these misfires in history. The assassin sent by the Sanhedrin to kill the resurrected Christ gets converted when he sees the resurrected Christ and starts a movement that basically undermines Christianity, undermines love one another as I love you. by convincing people that they're saved because somebody else got tormented and tortured and brutalized. What a bunch of bullshit. Love one another as I love you. Speak out. Love one another. Love your children enough to get off your asses. I say this everywhere I go. I say this in Austria, and people respond. You know, very, you know, serious, very high-level audiences in Germany have been responding since 1980. Why do you think Germany is going to be off of all fossil fuels by 2030? When the ambassador to the U.S. from Germany spoke in an unscheduled talk a couple of years ago at the Aspen Institute Environmental Forum, there was a guy, very famous scientist from this country, and the president of Shell Oil Company were sitting up on the stage. And the president of Shell Oil was saying, by 2030, we believe 30% of all of our needs can be met by non-renewables, or by renewables, sorry, not by non-renewables. And then Amory Lovins, the other guy who's head of the Rocky Mountain Institute, who also acknowledged in almost the same breath that he'd been working with Shell Oil for over 30 years as a consultant, says, well, I have to differ with you a little bit. I think that 35% of our needs can be met by 2030. And then the German ambassador is looking at these two guys, who I met this guy years ago. The German ambassador is looking at these two guys, and he looks at him and he goes, and he's a very highly educated, extremely articulate guy. And he goes, well, I have to differ with both of these individuals sitting here. He says, by 2030, Germany will be entirely renewables, entirely free of fossil fuel and nuclear. By 2030, we're ahead of schedule, actually. We should all be ahead of schedule, you see. Germany knows. Germany's not promoting this publicly right now at this moment, but I know because I was at the very first conference in November of 1980. I know how interested they are in these technologies. The best conferences...
In zero point
technologies, yes. I know that they're also very aggressive with solar in the interim and wind in the interim. Good for them. I'm all for solar and wind in the interim. I'm all for sun power 315-watt panels. I've got 40 of them sitting on top of the Institute facility in Tucson. 12.6 kilowatts when the sun is shining, you know, is a good thing. You know, I mean, it's, of course, after the inefficiencies of all the circuitry, you end up with 10 kilowatts out of 12.6 kilowatts. I mean, it's a joke. It costs a lot of money. It's a $93,000 system. How many people can afford that? Okay?
But didn't you have like multiple? It must have been difficult putting those solar panels on after you had created multiple systems for free energy use that were confiscated by the government.
Well, it was difficult in the sense of you could say no. It wasn't that difficult. I was like, well, this is what I'm legally allowed to do. And not only that,
but in the back of your mind, you must be thinking, but I don't need to do this.
Well, it drives my loved ones crazy.
Yeah.
My daughter, who has grown up eating, breathing, sleeping, and, you know, is got her degree and did a triple major, basically, in sustainable development. I mean, that there wasn't a sustainable development or environmental sciences department where she was. And there isn't again, but there was when she was there. And, you know, and she, you know, is incredibly frustrated, of course. But you know what? I'm just one guy in this movement. I'm just one guy.
Yeah, you're just one inventor. I mean, there's been Sparky Sweet and Dennis Lee.
There's Sparky Sweet and all these. I mean, there's Hubbard. I mean, look at these guys. I mean, it's just like, T. Townsend Brown, who was another friend of mine, who I met in the elevator going to our patent attorneys. We had the same patent attorney. And then we were on the elevator one day, and I looked at him, and I said, you know, you look really familiar. And he says, uh-huh. And I said, my name's Adam Trombley. Can I ask you your name? And he goes, my name is T. Townsend Brown. And I was like blown away because this is one of the electrogravitics. I mean, this is a guy who is one of the first guys, you know. He's a major figure.
Right, right. And
we ended up having a beautiful, until he died. We had a wonderful, long conversation.
According to John Lear, his father, William Lear, was working very closely with Thompson Brown and...
Townsend Brown.
Townsend Brown, sorry. And they had worked together on anti-gravity.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, so why don't I have a car?
That's because
off the ground.
Let me tell you what happened. Hazel Henderson is the former head of the Office of Technology and Assessment for the United States government. And she's a brilliant woman. She's really a neat person in a lot of ways. When she was head of OTA, Office of Technology Assessment, she had a special file for my work. And the reason I know this is because at the 2000 State of the World Forum in New York City, she walked up to me with Fritz Capra, Friedhof Capra, the Tao of Physics, the author of the Tao of Physics. And she said, in front of Ambassador George, former Canadian ambassador to Kuwait, former Canadian ambassador to Iran, former high commissioner to India, Nepal, Ceylon, and back in those days, still called Ceylon. And basically, in front of him and in front of a whole group of other scientists and things, she came up and she goes, Adam, I owe you an apology. And I said, she goes, I don't know if you remember me. And of course, I vaguely remembered her. And I said, and what is that you're apologizing for? She goes, well, my name is Hazel Henderson. And I said, yes, I know. And I when I was head of Office of Technology Assessment, I used to put any new technology with your name on it in a special file. I said, what was that, file 13? She goes, no, I didn't throw it in the wastebasket. I mean, I literally had a special file for your stuff. And I participated in the suppression thereof, anything that had your name on it. I said, why was that? She goes, well, I can barely drive in two dimensions in four-wheel cars, you know. They can barely drive with internal combustion engines. What are they going to be doing? They're floating around in their zero-point powered Ford flying saucers or Porsche flying saucers. What kind of chaos would that be? She goes, I just tried to, she goes, I couldn't even imagine this species with that kind of power. I said, I see. So you kind of, she goes, yes, I did. I made that judgment as the office, as the head of the Office of Technology Assessment for the United States government. And I said, so what changed your mind? She goes, well, Yul Brown changed my mind. You know, Yul Brown, who Brown's gas is named after.
Right. And the movie, there was a movie written about it called Chain Reaction.
Yeah, well, no, it's not Chain Reaction. It wasn't written about Yul Brown. Chain Reaction was actually written about something else. It was written by Michael Mann. It was the actual script was stolen and rewritten such that it was questionable. I know Michael, and it was questionable whether Michael could actually sue, even though he had registered the original script with the Screenwriters Guild. It's a long story, but that's not where Chain Reaction did not come from, Yul Brown. And I'm sorry, okay.
They built the premise of the movie around Brown's gas.
No, it was not built around Brown's gas. The premise of the movie was built around Zero Point initially, and that was the initial script. And Brown's gas was what I was doing because I was gagged relative to my work with Zero Point by federal decree, which they later denied issuing. Okay. I mean, I received a registered letter in the mail and I obeyed it. Okay. And then I had the opportunity to work with Yul on hydroxy gas as evolved from water, which is actually something that Victor Schauberger discovered in Germany during World War II, or actually it was prior to World War II when he actually made his initial pivotal discovery. And then he developed it during World War II. And that is that hydroxy, the stoichiometric ratio of hydrogen and oxygen as evolved through electrolysis can be co-evolved in a single volume, and it will not explode spontaneously up to a certain number of atmospheric pressures. And so you can pressurize this quite a bit, actually, and still not have it explode. And it doesn't explode when you detonate it. If you detonate it, Yul had this demonstration where we would take the gas, we would float into a cylinder of metal, which, strange to say, in the early days, he brought us a mild steel vessel, which rusted internally and then exploded, blew the top off, almost hurt me. But from that time onward, they were made out of stainless steel. And as the Chinese adapted his technology for welding, hydroxy welding, they make the vessels out of stainless steel now because they're smart enough to do that. But Yul was impecunious and made it out of mild steel. So the fact is that he didn't want to acknowledge Schauberger's role at all, in point of fact, when I met him. He was saved by Central Intelligence from a prison in Turkey. It's a long story. So he came to the United States, and we, anyway, what you take the stoichiometric measure of hydrogen and oxygen when you detonate it with a 10,000-volt spark, implodes. It's perfect combustion.
Okay. And
perfect combustion has no transverse expression of radiation. It's a cold flame when you make it into a flame. You can hold your, even though it's like over 3,000 degrees centigrade, you can hold your finger a quarter inch away and not get burned because there's no transverse radiation because it's perfect combustion. It's perfectly efficient combustion. That hydroxy gas recombines and makes a very hot blue flame. And if you do this in a chamber, like an internal combustion engine chamber, and you make it or design it correctly, and you cause it to implode instead of explode, instead of pushing that internal combustion cylinder against air pressure, which is part of the inefficiency of that system, by the way, because air pressure is pressing down on everything all the time. So instead of that energy of air pressure, that potential energy of air pressure working against the piston being driven by the explosion of the gas, which is an inefficient explosion, by the way, quite inefficient, leaving a lot uncombusted. But as it pushes against that cylinder against air pressure, like I said before, you lose efficiency. And when you detonate hydroxy gas and it implodes, air pressure goes to work for you. So it looks okay. like you're violating the second law again. You can get over 100% efficiency in a properly designed engine. Have no pollution, have no fuel cells at all. Okay, so this isn't a fuel cell technology. All that stuff is like completely ignoring the power of the stoichiometric mixture of hydroxy gas. Okay, and there's all these people making these devices for cars. There's one in Arizona that makes a device that actually bubbles the stoichiometric mixture up through the electrolyte mix, which is incredibly dangerous, and they're basically selling bombs to people. This is how poorly this is monitored in the United States. They're selling bombs to people. I couldn't believe this device when I saw it up close. It wasn't what was represented on the web because they'd improved upon it, they said. But the bottom line on this whole thing is we wanted to, in 1986, we said, okay, they're not going to let us do 0 point, so let us make a transitional economy with solar and wind and hydroxy gas.
Right.
Derived from water. Okay, and what are we going to be putting back into the atmosphere? We're going to be putting water vapor back into the atmosphere. Are you trying to? Okay. We're putting water vapor back into the atmosphere. We can make engines this way. We can make submarines this way. I mean, we designed all kinds of interesting prototype kind of ideas anyway. And basically, the company was shut down. You know, people became megalomaniac. The chairman of the board thought he was enlightened. He became megalomaniac. It's too much to get into all the details, but it was a government operation gone bad, I can tell you that much. And suddenly became defunded, let's put it that way. And it left several investors out in the lurch, but it wasn't because the technology wasn't good. It was because the political will wasn't there and the financing was cut off by the powers that be.
Right. So the reason we don't have floating cars with running on 0 point energy, at least in her mind, was that we're too stupid to drive them.
And actually because we're too stupid to drive them and we shouldn't have that kind of power in our hands. And the hydroxy thing, which she had also admitted to suppressing, the Brown's gas thing, it's a misnomer. It's not Brown's gas.
Okay.
There was plenty of that, believe me. But the fact of the matter is that she said she was finally converted by the fact that Chinese in 2000 were dedicating $1.3 billion to the development of Brown's gas in China. Now, why they're still building coal-fired power plants is another issue, but Yule ended up in a big conflict with the Chinese military, and finally he was trying to get me to move over there. He said he had 2,000 scientists who would be working under me, and I would be given a beautiful home in a gated community, et cetera, et cetera. All I had to do was move over and join them in China. And I said, I'm not going to do that until they apologize for Tibet. Of course, I'm not saying that I idealize about Tibet because Tibet was a friggin' medieval mess before that. And,
right.
And the Dalai Lama had a daddy number going on with Mao. You should have seen him when he was talking about it one day. But anyway, he's a good guy. I'm not saying he's a bad guy. But I mean, there's a whole story that people don't know. And here's the thing. We haven't been allowed to do any of it. is the bottom line. We have offered solution after solution after solution. Individual after individual, group after group has offered solution after solution after solution. We have physically demonstrated, not like fleshmen in ponds holding up an empty beaker saying that one at one time we created cold fusion. Okay? We have physically demonstrated it and still gotten clobbered, gotten defunded, gotten marginalized, anathematized. Okay? I had a period of time here in Aspen, Colorado, where people were coming into bars and acting, trying to pretend they were locals. And they would saddle up to the bars at like Kenichi's sushi restaurant. And they would say, "Hey, have you ever heard of this guy, Adam Trombley? He's what a fake." And not knowing that the guy at the bar, the bartender and the owner, well, one of the owners who just committed suicide last week when he changed his antidepressant, basically were my friends. And so we would play it, you know, we would just kind of sit there and let these guys spew their filth into the air and their misinformation. Mm-hmm. And then I would announce my presence, or they would introduce me to them. And then they would jump out of their chairs and run out of the building usually. Because this is the kind of disinformation campaign that has been used against me, against De Palma, against all kinds of people. And it's, so I'm not saying, well, poor me. I had friends, so I wasn't poor me at all. You know, my friends knew that I wasn't bullshitting them.
There's been multiple people who run into this, tried to scale the ramparts of the three pre-energy paradigm, and they've never made it to the moat.
Well, this is why we need a movement. Okay, people ask me, why is it that you won't? Why is it you don't just build more of these things? Well, every single time I build one, we get raided. Every time I build one, we get tormented. I mean, tortured. I mean, I have people flying into town, meeting me clandestinely and telling me that I can talk about it all I want, but if I build another one, they're going to make sure the next bullet doesn't miss. I mean, I literally had this happen just 2 years ago. The guy flew in to meet with me and sat down, and that's what he said to me in front of Nancy. And it's like, and then they started to, I get poisoned again anyway. So, you know. I have only deleted expletives to say to those people.
Right, right.
It's like, and ultimately I know that the most evil being in the midst of infinity will suffer radical decompression, will be transformed, every atom and molecule, every particle of their psychophysical presence and all of its entanglement will be liberated ultimately. And this is true of everything and everybody. And it's really good news. There is no eternal damnation. There is no eternal universe like this one. This universe is temporal. It is being transformed as we speak. It is being transformed in reality. And it will be transformed. And we can participate in the transformation in real time, or we can deny it and suffer the consequences. That's the choice that we have. We need to choose between life and a very slow and torturous death. That's what we need to remember. We need to remember with every day and with every breath that we have an obligation and a responsibility to life, which is quite remarkable. I love nothing more than spending time in a microscope or walking through a forest. And I'm joined by billions of people who would also equally enjoy those things, and who many of whom do, at least the forest part of it, where they can still find them. The fact is that we have an emergency. We can't afford to spend another day fighting another war, you know? And the people in Afghanistan need to rise up against the Taliban themselves, and the women in Afghanistan need to rise up against the Taliban, and they need to take little scimitars and do whatever they have to do. You know, they need to fight their own damn wars.
Right. Okay? I think what happens is when you see this all the time, and I don't know why this can't be a widespread phenomenon. Whenever anything disastrous is happening, people come together, and they come together to help each other.
If they know there's a disaster, you see, it's one thing if you have water up to your eyeballs in your living room in Missoula, Montana, or in Joplin, Missouri, a mile wide plus tornado has just touched down for 29 miles and taken out the majority of your town, and then had the U.S. government, of course, pretend that only a few hundred people died. Okay? I mean, what complete horseshit is that? Pardon me, but there's no polite way. See, the profanity is in the lie. The profanity is in pretending that more people weren't killed in Katrina. I talked to the boys who were taking the remains and putting them on refrigerator trucks. They wouldn't let Anderson Cooper or Gary Tuckman or these guys go and look at how many bodies there were in these refrigerator trucks, because there were so many more bodies than they wanted to acknowledge. That's why they wouldn't allow the press to see them, you see, because they don't want to cause a panic in the mollified little worker bees out there, okay? Well, excuse me. It's the panic. We are in an emergency. And as we said for years and years, how many times, and this is what Thrive says, what's it going to take? This is what Foster and I talked about in 2005 when he came and visited me. I said to him over and over again, what's it going to take? What's it going to take before people actually stand up and make a difference? How many towns, how many villages, how many cities have to be destroyed? How many millions of people have to suffer this poisoning before they say enough is enough? And we seize control of our political structures, and we seize control of our economic structures, and we say no more internal combustion engines. Only 0 point from this day forward, okay? You know, we don't have time for much of a transitional economy anymore. We can say, okay, solar and wind, good. Solar and wind are great, but we need 0 point, 0 point, 0 point, and we need it now, okay? And with that, I'm going to bid you adieu.
Actually, I'm gonna end it with a story about 0 point modules. Now, if people remember the 0 point module from Stargate, there's a show called Stargate, and they came up with the ZPM, and you have a story about that. Maybe we can end it there.
I told a dear friend of mine, John Lilly, about that we called the first piezo ringing resonance generator, kind of jokingly, David and I did, we called it the zero-point module. And I told John this, and John was avid, not just a fan, but apparently a ghostwriter as well for SG-1, Stargate Universe. You know, it's not Stargate Universe, Stargate. And so I was over at his house one day, and when Stargate was on, everybody shut up and listened to Stargate at a very high volume, by the way. And I just had been at the store, which was just down the road from his house. And he said, listen to this. And so Jack, the colonel at that time, before he became a general later on in the series, was talking, and he says, what we need is a 0 point module right now, you know? And it's like, and I looked at John and I said, John, and he goes, hey, millions of people are being exposed to this now, man. I said, but you got that from me. He says, yeah, who cares where I got it from? He says, all that's important is it gets out there. It's important that this becomes a part of the mindset, a part of the stream of consciousness of humanity. 0 point modules have existed, do exist, and should exist into the future. Warp drives, all the things that you've ever dreamed about and beyond in Star Trek can absolutely occur, or you can suffer slow, torturous death, constant environmental degradation, constant degradation of your life, bankruptcy, homelessness. It's your choice. You can have universal abundance, or you can be continually subjected to the IMF, the World Bank, and the central banking system of this world. And if I don't, you know, and if I die in the near future, if this body dies in the near future, I don't know. You know, I can only say it isn't me. I'm not the source of this. I'm just a guy who's I'm a witness to it. I'm a scientist. I'm a witness to it. I can testify to the reality of it. I can testify to the reality of the intelligence behind it. I can tell you it's not alien from life, this intelligence, that the intelligence that denies it is alien to life. And so we need to rid ourselves of that unintelligence, that stupidity. We need to rid ourselves of the parasites. We need to take our medicine, and we need to move into a new world or die trying. It's just that simple.
Okay. And I really want to thank you for spending this extended period of time explaining your process. And we didn't really even get into, I know there's so many other areas that we could have covered, but
future date. It's fine.
Okay, and I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.